Blog Talk Radio.
Another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Today, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke have very special guest Todd Matthews on the show called Identifying the Dead, Finding the Missing, an interview with Todd Matthews of Namos. It is, I've heard it, it is fantastic. You guys will love this. Todd, just give you a quick background, is the Director of Case Management and Communication for Namos. He joined the team in 2011 and program transitioned to the UNT Health Science Center. So you're going to get so much information with this, you're going to have your head's going to explode, basically. I mean, he's worked as a consultant for Discover ID. He's worked closely with Jerry Bruckheimer on The Forgotten and Dick Wolf on Lost and Found. So sit back, relax, and enjoy, because here is your host of Crime and Science Radio, Doug Lyle and Jim Burke.
Well, welcome everyone to another edition of Crime and Science Radio. I'm Jan Burke, along with your co-host, Dr. Doug Lyle. And we are really excited about our guest today is Todd Matthews, who's the Director of Case Management and Communications for Namos. He's going to tell us all about what Namos is, but we're really glad to be able to bring more attention to the great work they do regarding the missing and the unidentified. So welcome, Todd.
Well, it's great to be here, and thank you for having me.
Great to have you here.
So you've been at this for a long time, right? So
yep, well, at various stages of development. I actually really started in 1987.
Wow. You have been around for a while.
Of course, it wasn't as formal as it is now. You know, that's when I first realized that there were John and Jane Doe's out there. And I was 17 years old, and I started a little amateur. There was no internet at the time, so it was a very manual process of learning about the issues, and, you know, things just developed, and it's been a long time now.
Well, you have, like, a personal history with discovering the identities of remains and things like you said that we used to call Jane and John Doe's.
Yes.
They're more sophisticated now. Why don't you tell us about your background and how you got involved in all this?
Well, the funny thing is, it was in northern Kentucky. My father-in-law, 2 years before I was born, found the body of a young woman wrapped in a canvas tent wrapper. And for 30 years, she was known as the tent girl. I heard about the case when I met my bride in 1987. She told me about the case. Seemed very familiar for some reason. It was 20 years in then. You know, so that was, she had been a Jane Doe for nearly 20 years. So over the next 10 years, we got married, started life, and I tried to unravel the mystery of the tent girl. And until the internet came along, it was a very manual process. The information superhighway had the yellow stripe down it. And you literally had to go places to see things. I would go to where the body was found, libraries, newspapers, where the person was buried even. I mean, there was nothing off limits. If it was something that was related to the case, we went there.
You then had to put all that on the, then you had to, like, upload that into a database, or?
Well, once I had the information, it was, my database originally was a pile of papers that was getting very big. So I decided when I heard about the internet, I could go places online, and it was a very young internet. In 1998, it was, that's when I actually made my discovery. So what I decided to do was build a website for Tent Girl. So basically, I'd have like a wanted poster for her, kind of like a wanted poster in reverse. I have a person and I want to introduce somebody. So that's what I was attempting to do. So I built the website, but I continue to look. You know, I anticipated the family would contact me. That's my person. There had been exhumation. At some point, the body would be returned to the family, and it would be over. You know, nothing else. But what really happened, I got the website up, I waited for a bit. A couple of months went by, and still nothing. You know, nobody found me. So I continued to do what I'd been doing a few years before, and that was going online and looking for somebody that might be looking for her. You know, like the Craigslist today, there was a website called Crane and Hibbs at the time, and it was just pretty much a wall. Lost dog, cart sale, lost loves. I had several different topics. And going through that one night in January of 1998, I found a woman looking for her sister, last known alive, December 1967, Lexington, Kentucky, very near where the body was found, and I knew that was it. It was the search was over. I had no idea that that was such a needle in a haystack moment, but it I was certain. I found my needle.
Well, so we'll try and fill in some of the gaps between these two giant leaps, but you're now with Namus, and boy, I look forward to the day when everyone in the United States knows exactly what that means in the way that they know what the FBI is. But tell us what Namus is and what it does.
Well, a few years ago, you know, we had several websites that attempted to be a national database. You know, I had done it work here. There were several efforts to try to put the information together, and I didn't realize how complicated it was going to be. And ultimately, in 2007, I got a call from the Department of Justice. They asked me to sit on an advisory board to create the Namus database. We had the unidentified online in a website already, and they wanted to build in the missing persons component and put the two databases together and let it search each other, and that's exactly what we did. And I thought, 2007, the trip to D.C., I thought this was my first and my last. Never had a thought that I would ever go back. And then the working group started and kept asking me to return, and sometimes I felt like they were struggling with things, but, we've already done that 2 years ago when we encountered that issue ourselves. And I actually did have things. So slowly I began raising my hand and telling them, here's my opinion. Take it or leave it, and, you know, very often they were very respectful, but listened, and I felt like I was able to really contribute something.
Yeah.
So now it is the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System, so essentially our national database for missing and unidentified.
And it's run by the federal government now.
It is funded by the National Institute of Justice, and it's managed through the University of North Texas Health Science Center. They've been on the program in 2011, when it went out for a competitive bid, they already had the DNA database. The DNA lab that uploads into CODIS already at the University of North Texas Health Science Center. They decided to go after the grant for the operational of Namus, and they asked me to be one of the directors, should they get it. And they did, and the opportunity came. I never thought I was even qualified to do this. And, you think, I'm not sure I can do it. And it's really, it's not been that difficult. It's a lot of work, I will say that, but it's not been something unfamiliar. You know, these things have solutions, and sometimes it's just common sense. Here's what we need to do.
How many people do you have working with you now at Namus?
With Namus, we have approximately 25 people.
Okay.
So there is some crossover with the lab, so some of the people that are on one grant are actually partly on another grant, so we had a few hybrids between the grants, but it's roughly 25 people.
That's good. Well, I was going to ask that. I mean, you work at the Forensic Science Unit at the University of North Texas, and obviously you do other things besides this. Tell us a little bit about that. What do you do there?
Well, there, I'm never there. I'm rarely there. It's like four times a year that I actually go to University.
Oh.
So most of our staff work remotely. I stayed in Tennessee. That's my home, so I work remotely from my home office, and often we will travel for Namus on behalf of Namus. And four or five times a year, you know, I'll spend about a week each visit at the University of North Texas Health Science Center. You know, Namus is online, so you don't physically have to be at University of North Texas to manage the system. So and that speaks for itself. So it's like you don't have to go to any certain area to manage it. It's remote. All of our staff, the regional systems administrators, that's a role that I formerly had, they are actually, they're in the region that they serve. So we have like 7 regions in the United States. And the RSAs actually live in the region that they manage. So they literally can step out the door and represent NamUs exactly where they're at.
Now, but there is also a very famous forensic anthropology center at the university, right?
Yes. Actually, it's north of Fort Worth in Denton, and we do have a lot of overlap with that group. You know, they provide free forensic anthropology for law enforcement criminal justice users. So, you know, they're going to give you skeletal remains are found. They can give you an analysis to give you some idea of cause of manner, death, age, race, sex, anything that they could possibly tell you from literally reading the bones.
So, and is that, we'll get into some of these real particulars about it first, but among the services that are there is something called, I guess it would be pronounced Eden.
Now, probably Eden is it's everybody deserves a name. I developed that in 2001. So technically the university and the government don't provide that service. It is a service that we can recommend to people. It was the idea that forensic artists, professional volunteers, could donate their time. You know, and I wanted to do that because in the Doe Network I found that a lot of people did my facial reconstructions because of cost prohibition. So they couldn't do it. So I asked artists if you could donate occasionally a reconstruction to an agency that might not otherwise afford it or might not do it. Would you be willing to do that? And that was in 2001, and they still do it. And there was a day where there was more. You know, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit at the time with unidentified remains that were available that needed attention that didn't have, you know, we didn't have names. So, you know, people were struggling to find any service that they could possibly find. So it's still going strong. We still do facial reconstructions as needed, and again, it's completely 100% volunteer artist.
Now, you mentioned that NamUs started in 2007, and what's interesting to me is that it's the very same year that the National Institute of Justice published a report by Nancy Ritter, who's a researcher, and it was entitled Missing Persons and Unidentified Remains, the Nation's Silent Mass Disaster.
Yes.
And I remember the sort of bombshell effect that had, at least in the forensic science community, because there was a lot of media coverage about that. And one of the things that she had said was that there were more than 40,000 sets of human remains that can't be identified through usual means, and they're in evidence rooms, in ME's, and coroner's offices across the U.S. And of those 40,000 at that time, in 2007, only 6,000 had been submitted to the FBI database that was then in use. I think it was the NCI or maybe the BICAP, I don't remember which of the two. But, so what are the factors that contributed to our being in a situation like that?
Well, I think, you know, we didn't have a national database. You know, at the time, and people were doing their own thing. They had their own local policies and procedures. You know, had I known there were 40,000 when I was looking for the tent girl, I might have gave up. I might have thought this is an impossible task. What, how can I possibly do that? So I'm thankful I didn't know that when I started, or it might have really cut my search very short. But, you know, it was a survey, and that's an estimation, so it's not an actual tabulation. So, you know, they sent out surveys, and, you know, they got X number, and they realized that some agencies didn't respond, or maybe they had more than they thought they had. Some were buried, and might not even remember where they were buried. So we know that was a study, I think it was in 2004, the survey went out. It took a great deal of time for that to be completed. And sometimes I think we need a new survey, just not only to just guess at something, but maybe get a more actual number. And some of the cases are still not named. You know, we have well over 10,000 cases in NamUs in the unidentified side. Now, we actually have more than NCI have for unidentified bodies, but sometimes it's a matter of a case can't go in until a body gets wound and some type of analysis is done. You know, I've been to exhumations in the past 7 months, I think, and, you know, very little was known about that person until an exhumation took place, or maybe DNA wasn't collected because they didn't know to collect it at the time the body was buried.
Well, between 2007 and now, what do you see the major changes in this whole process?
Well, I see people, you know, they're using more standard practices now, not because they're made, but because they're adopting them. I think that now more people are familiar with the single format of NamUs, and I see people starting to adopt similar patterns using the same terminology. You know, you're seeing a lot of similarities now. And I'm seeing cases go in more rapidly. I'm seeing the need to exhume the body because one of the things that NamUs can do, NamUs can actually generate a possible match. So even if we have a little bit of information on the body and we don't have the DNA, this happened just very recently, we can actually, the system can actually say these people are possible matches for your unidentified body and vice versa. It's worked both ways. And here's what we know. And sometimes it's a matter of, okay, there's going to be no way to exclude this person or make an identification unless that body is exhumed. And that gives them a reason, an investigative lead is what's generated, to exhume that body and go through the process. So they have a good reason. And their DNA is free. You know, it comes in from the grant at the University of North Texas. It doesn't cost the agency anything, not even shipping.
Well, you mentioned you wish that there was another study, and I see you know more, but in your opinion and the data that you have at hand, how big is this problem now? I mean, how many unidentified remains are there in the U.S.? Like,
I say I would almost venture, hate to venture to even guess. I think I could be surprised either way. I think we have hit a plateau. You know, I think we did get to the point where a lot of cases surged in. And then we got to the point where we exceeded NCIC's tabulation because, you know, medical examiner and coroners can't always access NCIC to actually put their case into the system. So sometimes they didn't, you know, NCIC didn't know about it. So once we exceeded that number, you know, we did see a bit of a slowdown. We've seen cases be resolved. So even though we stayed over, you know, close to 13,000 and we've stayed consistent at that number, cases are still coming in because cases are being archived at the same time. So, it would really be hard to say exactly how big the problem is, but I do know that it's a big problem. It's huge, you know, and what's relevant about the families. They are the ones looking for these people, and I encourage the families of the missing to look at the problem as a whole and not look at just their individual part of that problem, which is their missing person. They have to consider that any of these bodies could potentially, so it's almost like adopted in a way. You know, think about all of these could be your person to some degree or a situation very similar to yours. So, and that's important. And now that we have NamUs online and we're able to literally look these bodies, you know, look at what was left instead of just reading about it or hearing about it, we're able to see fragments of clothing that was found, jewelry, maybe something that was in a person's pocket. Sometimes we're able to see bones. Sometimes you see an entire facial reconstruction. And I think we had to literally look this problem in the face. And that's what we're doing.
So we have that half of the equation of the unidentified remains. How about the other half of the equation? Do we have any idea, is there any way to know how many open cases of missing persons are active in the U.S. right now?
Yeah, I know that NCIC has a tabulation of around 85,000. So it's going to be in the mid-80s. And we don't have anywhere near that in NamUs. But now, the important thing to remember, NamUs is not a hot case repository. So a lot of these cases are open and closed very, very quickly. So they have a high number, but they're in and out constantly. So if I go missing this morning, I don't necessarily need to be in NamUs and being compared to the deceased by tonight. But maybe I should be an NCIC, you know, so that law enforcement can have an NCIC access in the field. If my name shows up, they're able to respond to it. I'm picked up in a call or if I'm found injured somewhere, they can query NCIC. And it just operates in a different way. I don't think there's not really a competition between NamUs and NCIC. There are two different ways of doing things. And, you know, they're definitely two entities that can share information. We do share information. I think we should share more information, and I think that's going to happen in the future.
I hope so.
Absolutely.
We earn it. Things are fair for what you wish for, you know, because it's a lot of data and it's going to take a lot of process. You know, I brought up that idea in the study again, and I get a little, you don't know how hard that was. So I try to listen to people and they say that maybe you shouldn't do that right now, or let's wait till you get to this point because it's going to be a bigger thing than you think. So I listen to good advice if I can get it.
Well, you mentioned Catgirl as having, you know, brought you into this arena, but can you tell us about a couple more of your interesting cases that you encountered over the years, things that were unusual or particularly poignant, or things that stuck out and that you remember?
There's two cases, and those are the two informations that we recently did. Harlan County, Kentucky, a body was found after the tent girl, and didn't know about it. It was about 1969. So she was found. It was Harlan County, Jane Doe. She was found in the mountains of eastern Kentucky. Never heard of that case before. I actually found a reference to Tent Girl in a ghost story book. And basically they said the Tent Girl of the mountains, which would have been Harlan County, Jane Doe. And then I looked and I thought, this isn't just a story. It's just a story of historical, creepy things that had happened in that county in Kentucky. I contacted the author. And she took me to the grave, you know, traveled to Harlan County, Kentucky, and this was still before Natus when I first ventured into this particular case. It's been a few years ago, and there was a grave, and there was a Jane Doe, and then the coroner did have some records. What I found was that the medical examiner didn't know about that case, so the state medical examiner had no record of her. The reason was very clear. She existed and died before the state medical examiner formed. So the current coroner, he inherited it many, many years later, so he didn't know necessarily that the state didn't have it. They didn't really have a website. He just go look. So I guess people assumed that everybody knew, but had she not have made a reference to Tent Girl in her book, which shined out like a flare, you know, I saw that, and I approached her, and it turned out that that was just more than a ghost story. That was a real case, and we made a pinch that, you know, if we could send the body, and there's an opportunity to do a DNA analysis now. And yes, the system did give us an opportunity to have some investigative links. So it was just incredible to be there, you know, from start to finish on that.
But you mentioned DNA analysis on this case before you go to the other one. Do you use familial DNA in some of these searches?
So here's what we did. We will actually, the bone sample can actually be mailed to the University of North Texas, and they will extract, you know, a DNA sample from that and from families. What we would ask from you is a tick swab. You know, if you have a missing person, very rarely use a direct sample because sometimes they're just not available, and a toothbrush and a hairbrush is really hard. But if we have mom and we have dad and we have siblings, known relatives, we have law enforcement to collect the sample, and that's postage-free to the University of North Texas, and they develop a profile to enter into CODIS. And the only thing that will be compared, if we take your DNA sample, the only thing that will be compared to will be unidentified remains.
Okay, cool. And you mentioned there were two cases. What was the other case that stands out to you?
The second one's another Eastern case. It's from East Tennessee, though. I heard about a case years ago, probably 2001. It's still Doe Network days. A woman that had been found along I-75 in Campbell County. It's another area where there's not many of them. So it was sort of a rare thing. It's very close to me. So I made contact to law enforcement. We were both kind of referenced in a court TV article, me because of their network, and this detective looking to identify as Jane Doe because of this case. So I traveled, met with him, and I asked him, why don't you have a facial reconstruction for this Jane Doe? And that was when he said, we don't really have the money for it right now. And I really didn't even know what to do, and that's when Project Eden was born. I said, if I ask a friend that I have as a forensic artist to do this at no cost, can we try? I literally drove home with a head in a double bag.
Yeah.
I did. And I was just a civilian at the time, but that's how badly law enforcement and medical examiners at the time were needing these resources. You know, I certainly don't recommend it now. I mean, well, we don't want to send a skull home with a civilian so that he can get facial reconstruction. But they needed these resources so badly at the time that they took a leap of faith, and thank God they did, because we were able to give birth to a lot of new products because of that. You know, Project Eden has done reconstructions on literally dozens and dozens of cases now.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to take a brief break, and we will be back in just a moment. Okay. All right, welcome back, everyone. We are talking with Todd Matthews of Namath, and he's just told us about some amazing cases. And in fact, there are more about Todd and his work can be found in a book by one of our previous guests. Deborah Halber was on our program, and she talked about The Skeleton Crew, which prominently features Todd. And it's also really the book is about the amateur internet sleuths who work on these cases. And these groups are still very much around from the time you were talking about earlier in the program about the whole way in which this grew up out of like a paper system to a early internet system to a website and then several websites. So how did those groups interface with Namath?
So, you know, they stuck in. You know, the volunteer community, and that's, you know, I'm representative of that. That's where they got me. So that in itself, it shouldn't be just taken as a vote of confidence in me, but in the volunteer community as a whole. They realized that they needed more hands and realized that they needed help. And, you know, some of the things that we did early on kind of demonstrated, well, maybe the public can help, you know. So that's really where they're still at, you know. Doe Network, you know, it still exists and there's still a need for it. It's not a competitor for Namath. It's actually, you know, I still own the website. I still own the domain name. I want the volunteers to keep doing what they're doing. I still want to make it available to them. It's not a competition for Namath. You know, they have anecdotal data. They have newspaper clippings, just like I did with the Camp Girl, just snippets of information. And Namath is more of a biological repository. So we have a description of what was found and where it was found. But we actually have a place in the system where law enforcement can see the DNA is housed at here under this reference number, so they know where to find it. We upload fingerprints, not just the numerical data, but actually the real fingerprint. If they're available, we upload them into the system for law enforcement. Dental records, radiographs, x-rays, anything that we can find of the missing and unidentified, they're there. So the good thing about the public user is often they make us aware of cases we didn't know about. You know, they have these newspaper articles that say, hey, Harlan County Jane Doe, had that lady not written a book about it, I still wouldn't know about it. And everybody would have assumed that everything's already been done. So there's still a big need, and this is the first government database that anybody can initiate a missing person's entry into the system. Anybody. Any American citizen that has access to the Internet can actually give us information on a missing person. So if you have a next-door neighbor, whatever, you know, somebody that is legitimately missing, and we will verify that, you can enter the primary data into the system. One of our staff will take that data, make contact with you, local officials, and ultimately try to determine if this is a real case. And if it is, we need to start collecting biometrics. That will be in their fingerprints, and we start telling them, here's what we have, it's free. So right now, short of the federal mandate to require the use of the database, we have a lot of nice, cool, free stuff, you know, because you might not have a forensic odontologist on your staff in a rural area of law enforcement. We want, you can borrow ours. You might not have an anthropologist. You can borrow ours. And that's a big deal because a lot of these cases are not, there's not a lot known about them because they didn't have it. Like Kent Crow originally, they thought she was a young person because she was small. They thought she was 13 to 16 originally, and then they changed the estimate a little later. Turns out she was 24. The reason they didn't know, somebody, you know, possibly a lay person made a determination, that was like a child, she's small. Or a pathologist, you know, wasn't able to age her correctly, you know, her remains were decomposed. They didn't have a forensic odontologist, and they didn't have an anthropologist. So when those two entities did look at her later, she was 24, and she'd given birth. She was a full-grown woman. She was small. And I think we're going to find a lot of that stuff in these cases that have kept them unidentified for years.
Well, besides those things, I mean, obviously, a lot of coroners, you know, obviously they're not trained in forensic anthropology, and so they would get the age wrong and the aging yes. skeleton wrong, et cetera. And then there's the sheer volume that you mentioned earlier. But what are some of the other reasons that these missing person cases continue to go unsolved for so long?
Well, you know, a lot of these, there's a lot of bodies that have not been found. You know, that's a big deal. So we're trying to put together a puzzle without all the pieces. So we have a lot of unidentifieds and a lot of missings that don't necessarily correspond with each other. So we've got, literally, like I said, a puzzle with a lot of missing pieces. And I think that finding them and making sure that they're in the database is going to help solve these, because the Harlan County Jane Doe, she wouldn't have hoped if we hadn't had information on her. Nothing. So, I mean, that information had to be acquired. So we have to keep reaching out to people. We need all the pieces so that we can start putting things together and getting some of the backlog out of the way. And then I think moving forward is going to be a lot easier, because we will have standard practices. I think NAMIS says, now the body's found today. I think this is one of the first places that they go after they do their local process. NAMIS is the first place to go. And originally with NAMIS, we were going to go back in time to get information. We were going to look at older cases, and, you know, that's where we're just going, oh, gosh, that was buried, and they didn't collect the sample. They didn't know to. So, like, okay, now we're going to take modern forensic science back to that time period and do what they couldn't do or didn't know to do. It's not that they did it wrong. It's just they did all they had at the time. Thank God they're buried, and usually it's not that difficult process. I hear people that'll play up an examination like it's an extremely difficult process, but it's really not. The last two times I had were hand digs. Somebody had a little knowledge of, you know, what's in the ground, collected the samples from the ground, and literally like a screen, you know, just like a screen, like you would screen dirt, place them in that, the bones in that, and, you know, simply closing the grave afterwards.
Well, I just improving, you know, the expertise of the people involved, and then getting the systems in place are huge. Is there anything else you can pinpoint that would also help with this process, other than things you've mentioned?
I think you're letting the public user know that it is important to you, whether you have a missing person or not. You could have. So NAMIS is not something that you shouldn't pay attention to unless you have a need for it. It's good to be aware of it. And you have to think, even from a public safety standpoint, 40,000 bodies, and the majority of these are homicide victims because of foul play. So if we have that many people that are murder victims, who did it? And are they still out there among people? You know, do they continue to be dangerous? Are they serial killers? So I think it should be important to everybody. The more of these cases we identify, the more likely somebody's going to actually be punished for doing these crimes. So I think it's really important. It should be important to everybody, and I hope people realize it.
So missing person cases can be especially hard on the families of the missing. I have very strong memories of times when I've been speaking somewhere and someone who has a missing person in their family talks to you. It always is just heartrending. What are some of the consequences for people who may not have been thinking about this? What are some of the consequences to the family? I know there are emotional ones, but there's also financial and other kinds of consequences for them.
Well, it stops everything. I mean, in a sense, how do you continue to go to work? How do you continue to function? The things that you once cared about, you don't care about anymore. So it's a death blow to a family. It's going to alter the situation drastically. I've seen families rip apart because of it. I've seen other families grow closer because of it. And honestly, I can honestly say that sometimes missing is worse than dead. I've literally taught the families that I've had to tell them, okay, there was a comparison. It's not your son or it's not your daughter. And I've seen them, it just crushed them because they thought, okay, I'm finally able to do the normal process, which is to take my loved one's remains and bury them, have the grieving period, and then try to make life go on. It's the not knowing is the whole thing. You cannot have the grieving process. I think we're programmed to understand death as humans and process it, but I don't think we can just gone. We're just not good at that. That's not compute.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned earlier about public safety, and a lot of these are homicides. Can you expand on that a little bit? And does NAMIS really focus on that as far as, you know, the FBI, other law enforcement, when you are...
Well,
Well, and we have relationships with VICAP and the agencies, and some, you know, law enforcement agencies, you know, they have a crime as well as an unidentified body. So we try to make sure that they have everything, you know, the cause and manner of death. If it's possible that our team can help determine that, and most importantly, the identification. So once you have a name, I think they can far more easily decide who might be a suspect or who might have been tied in. You know, you find a body in Tennessee, and you find that she was a missing person from Florida. Who knew that person? So those two agencies can start talking to each other, and they start figuring things out. And I've seen notes that go back into the system where things that were just, it's just so obviously true. You know, they had theories with the body or a missing person. Then we have both halves of the puzzle going together, and that fit. That fit really good. And that's something that we can offer back to law enforcement. Here's all we have. Do what you can with it. You know, I know we can't usually go down that road with them. Our job is primarily to make identifications and help them to determine cause and manner of death. But after that, you know, they have an incredible opportunity to potentially solve that case.
Well, I mean, that's true. I mean, most murders, the killer and the victim have some kind of relationship. And
yeah.
So identifying the victim is absolutely critical in tracking down the perpetrator.
Rare convictions on unidentified. You know, they do happen when somebody's killed an unidentified person, but it's rare you're going to see anything unless we actually know who that person is.
Exactly. Well, one of the complaints that you hear about is that, you know, blue-eyed blondes get all the media attention and that some groups are more ignored than others. And sometimes the most vulnerable members of society are the ones that get the least attention. Gary Ridgway got away with what he was doing for so long because he killed prostitutes that nobody cared about and dumped the bodies, you know, along the Green River. But what about this situation? I mean, that the most vulnerable are the ones that are least likely to be identified.
Well, that's, you do see the trend where people, people that were prominent in the community, they were known, loved by many, having an air of innocence about them. You know, it's easier to get attention on a missing woman than it is a missing man. There's no doubt about it. You know, not that there's no attention for missing men. It's just more likely, and it turns out there probably are more unidentified males out there than females. So, you know, we have to think about that. And I tell the media that when we talk. I've even had media make changes in the way that they do things, and they'll come back and say, "Do you have a case that represents something that you don't normally see on television?" You know, maybe some of some might consider undesirable for the community. You know, do you have people that are missing that maybe nobody cares about, and maybe we can change that? And, you know, we can do that. I think it's just important we open our eyes to the whole and just say, this can be anybody that this can happen to.
Well, we've talked a little actually already about how these become cold cases and how you end up working on them. So I'm going to just kind of go ahead a little and say, as Doug always warns anyone when we're out speaking together, that don't get me going on the topic of the medical lethal death investigation so-called system, which really isn't one at all. It's just this wild patchwork. And I think a lot of people, especially people who live in urban areas where there may be a budget that allows for a medical examiner and someone who's going to be board certified with the National Association of Medical Examiners and has a degree in forensic pathology and all of that. That Quincy does not work through most of the United States.
Yeah.
The people in these offices very often have no forensic training, no law enforcement training, no medical training. If they're a doctor, they may be an OBGYN or somebody who really has no pathology background. They may be the local mortician, a funeral home director or someone because he's got the means to go pick up a body. And yet they're really not people who in some jurisdictions not required at all to have any training. So to me, it just seems like since we don't have these protocols in place, that's contributing to all this. And sometimes it is, as you've mentioned already, it's budget. It's that it's a little rural county that the coroner doesn't even have an office. he may not have a computer, you know. So what should we have in place, like just nationally, and what do you think the public should be doing about that?
Well, I think that, you know, the encouragement for the, you know, since we have, you know, people, a lot of people will complain about the way things are, but now that we've made the system open to where anybody can put an in-person reporter and at least bring it to our attention, that's put a little bit of power back in people's hands. So I'm hoping they'll take advantage of that maybe more than they do. You know, it's easy to say somebody's not doing the job and get them in there. It's a little harder to say, you know what, I'll do it. I'll do it. We do have people out there that do that. And as far as, I think NamUs is kind of putting similar patterns out there. You know, we can't make anybody do a certain thing in a certain way. Without a federal mandate, we're not going to say, here's what you're going to do. You know, so, but we can give them easy choices. You know, we have a forensic odontologist. We have this for you. You can borrow ours. And then even filling out the NamUs form when they're putting bodies in there, I'm seeing people become more consistent. So you would see more of a difference in the way people handled their cases before. They would have their own forms, their own this and that that might not really overlap with what the way another agency done it. And now that we're all more familiar with a sort of a standard way of doing it, I think NamUs has helped bring in a little bit of standardization, you know, inadvertently to people, just giving them something that they're all familiar with, I think. So, and I have seen people getting better and better at putting their cases in the system. Like they just a little clunky when they first started, and then you see them really start streamlining. And they know what we're going to ask them, and they got it ready for us. So there's no surprise now. They've already been down the road. They've already visited with us. They know what we're going to ask them for next. And now I'm going to say, go back and get this for me. I need this, and here's why. So I do see improvement. It's going to take a long time. And there was a time that I thought, I want to see all of these 40,000 eliminated. I have realized now that I'm a grandfather myself that I will not live to see a day that this is no longer an issue. You know, I know that I'm not going to see the end of it, but I do know that I saw the beginning of the change. And I try not to work on individual cases so much now as it is, how about I just do that work on all of them by trying to help find new resources, better ways of doing things, better ways to streamline these processes. At least I can speed it up. I might not make it to the end. At least we can certainly speed up processes, and I think we have. And you have to be satisfied with that. You know, Tent Curl brought out an incisive nature for me. And Deborah details in the book very well, and I had to be cured of that, too. I had to realize, no matter how obsessed you're going to get with this, you are not going to make it go away. We just have to treat the issue and not cure it. And I have to be happy with that. And I think I found a way that I can be happy with that because we are seeing positive changes. So I'm content now.
Absolutely. That's great. Well, let's flip it around the other way. Our listeners out there, if they have families or friends that are in this cadre of missing people,
mm-hmm.
What do you want them to know about NamUs, and what should they do? What's the steps they should take to on an individual basis to enter this system and draw attention?
Well, first of all, I can check the system to make sure that the case is in our system, whether it's in our law already. If it's not, you can register the user, make us aware of it by starting an entry. Or if a case is in there already, they find out, okay, this missing person is using it. Take a look at it. You know, because we found that having the public access to these cases is an incredible Q&A tool. It really is. The quality has come forward because I've had people that have told me, well, this says this address, but actually, you know, that was a misstatement in a news article. And you go back and you take another look at it and say, okay, maybe there was a little more clarity that could be added here. Or it prompts you to ask a question. I've had people that have told me, you know what, the height is off. I was taller than her. You do a little more check on it, check in with it a little more. A lot of times NCIC and law enforcement get details of a missing person from a Caruthers Scott family. And you're asked the height of somebody they're about to, and you might not know how much of their weight. I don't know. You might not know exactly how much somebody weighs. So, you know, a lot of guesswork does, and in that moment, they're very upset at that point in time. So sometimes after a little bit of time has passed, they can go check and make sure there wasn't any things that weren't specific enough. I bet family members have said, oh, that's a nice, you know, rabbit, but, you know, it also had a tattoo on the back of its hand. Really? You know, so that's an identifying factor. We've had families that have said, you know, he had that broke leg, too, and they had to put three screws in his ankle. Ah, okay, that's an identifying factor. So sometimes you work on these cases, you find out there's a lot more data. There's a lot more data to be had from the family than what they might have offered at their initial missing persons report. I had Jan Smolinski, mother of Billy Smolinski, you know, one of the most famous missing adult males in the country. That's the Help Find the Missing Act. He's also called Billy's Law. I was at a conference with her at one time. She was in attendance, and I was doing an AMIS presentation. I asked for permission. It's law enforcement. Do you mind if I pull up Billy's file and share it with the family, with the people that are watching, you know, law enforcement in the room? Well, by all means, you know, do it. And step by step, we went to the case. We looked at what we had. Got the fingerprints, and there was nothing. And I said, so unfortunately, Billy was never fingerprinted, so we have nothing here. And she said, yeah, the only point that there was any type of fingerprinting was they got his thumbprint. He drove the school bus, and it was for his work. Well, you know what? We have fingerprints. It's a fingerprint. But had we not have had that discussion there, what she thought of in her mind, a tradition of fingerprint, wasn't what we considered. And so we happily take that thumbprint. That was great. So, and we have people that will come back and they'll give us additional dental records, you know. Well, this is his normal dentist, but he also had an oral surgery here. And we can make contact with that agency, you know, through that. Because this is medical and investigative, you know, HIPAA laws, well, you know, we can still get your dental records should we need them if you're missing. So the medical community will work with us. But I think that's it. Take a look at the families or friends and loved ones. Take a look at it. Do you have anything else you could add? Is there something else that you know that we might not know? And certainly let us know. And there's easy ways to contact people. If you look at the NAMIS website, the contact information is everywhere, 800 number, toll-free number, give us a call. We'll check it out.
I think that's a great point you made, or several great points there. And I think people need to know that. I think people don't understand what identifying information is available on all of us. And it is things like fractures and surgeries and appliances and dental appliances and tattoos and birthmarks and all these things that make everybody different. And each one of those or any one of those could be the key that locks the identification. And medical examiners use this all the time when they're trying to solve a murder case, and they'll look for implanted pacemakers, so they'll look for previous fractures, they'll look for tattoos. You know, they photograph gang tattoos, for goodness sake. So I think it's a great point that you made, that families just don't know what's important information. It just, well, I never thought that was important. Well, it is.
Oh, yeah, and they will. I have families that literally tell me that, well, I didn't think that made a difference. It's like, yeah, it does. And we're actually living in a time period where people very frequently tattoo and medical implants, body piercings, you know, those are all identifying features. So should I have a teenage niece that decided that she wanted to get a tattoo, maybe I wouldn't complain. I might not like it, but if she got it, I'd have to think, well.
Well, and some of these tattoo artists have loyal followings, and they have a specific style, and you can see a tattoo and say, well, I know Joe over, you know, on 42nd Street does this work. And that may be the key. You never know. You just never know.
We want those photographs out there, and even jewelry. Sometimes we've got reports for a photo of jewelry. It says gold ring, blue stone. So, you know, I actually have some relatives here in my town that own a jewelry store. So I said, okay, blue, you know, gold ring, blue stone. Can you give me a better description of that? And they'll say, oh, well, that's a Southeastern turquoise. They were manufactured, and, you know, they stopped making these back in 85. Or these were mass-produced all over the country. There's billions of them. Or they could tell, oh, that's a handcrafted piece. That was probably one very unique piece of jewelry. So if we can find more information on a piece of jewelry just by asking maybe the professional, which would be the jeweler, maybe we can enhance it a little more, get a little better description.
Well, I'm going to ask two quick questions as we come to the end of our time here. It's just flown by, Todd. I want to ask, I've been approached by people who were told, you know, back in the day, now these are cold cases, obviously, but, you know, someone who may have been told, say, in the 70s when son went missing. Sometimes local police agencies, at least around here, would say to people, you know, well, they're probably just a runaway. There's nothing we can do about that. And they really wouldn't put any effort into helping that family. And sort of, especially if they were no longer a minor. It's kind of like adults run away all the time. And they do, you know, but that doesn't mean they're all escaping responsibility. Some of them may have been homicide cases. So if you don't have a police report, can you still come to NamUs and get help?
Yes, it's not the traditional way of doing it, but, you know, you still can, and especially I've had law enforcement tell family, go home and wait. Back in the 70s, 80s, go home and wait for them. Well, they didn't mean to wait 30 years and not come back. They didn't say go home forever and wait. They said go home and wait. You know, they probably thought, well, if they're still missing, they would have come back by now. But yes, actually you can, and we get this all the time. You know, in fact, I have a local person that's looking for an aunt. And it turns out that it might be more than just a person that decided to move into another area who there's no trace, because he's a genealogist. And he said, there is no trace of my aunt Leah, so we have no reason to think that she just picked up and moved. Maybe I need a missing persons report. So what we're going to do is work with him, get his aunt's information into NamUs, and then try to get a local agency to help me validate this or one of our staff. To actually say, okay, we're going to take this as a missing persons case. You know that we probably are not going to be out in the ground search for, but it allows us to get into the national database when we have a legitimate agency that takes it, gives us a case file number. Then we can start literally looking among the dead for that person. And that's what it takes sometimes. And some of our greatest files have came in like that because we simply just didn't have the data before that person stepped forward and said, hey, what about my case? And sometimes they don't realize it. It really could have been a real missing persons case instead of just moving on.
Yeah. Well, here's my last question real quickly. So those who don't have missing people in their families and who aren't themselves forensic artists or able to help in that way, what can other individuals who want to help out do to help NamUs with its work?
Well, and there's many different people that do things, but recently, three books have been written. One was fiction and two weren't fiction. And they mentioned NamUs as part of the story and included Deborah Howard's book, which is the fourth one that I know of right offhand. Making NamUs become a mainstream word where it's like everybody knows what FBI is. Everybody knows what BICAP is. Most people know what CODIS is. But I think NamUs becoming more of a standard household word, and the media helps us with that. Even books and fictional things. Television shows sometimes will throw these first NamUs for a hit. That's great. Keep doing that, you know. And I think just awareness and spreading awareness. If you read a story, share it on social media if you see it. You know, even if it's, you know, that's not normally your thing. Maybe if you just share that story, you might be giving some piece of information that might be exactly what they were looking for. Just like the Harlan County Haunts book. They had something I was looking for. I just didn't know it.
Well, maybe I'm also thinking, I'm seeing out more and more of these in the news of communities that are having missing persons days where they encourage families of the missing to submit DNA to NamUs. So maybe some of you out there could also think about talking to your local law enforcement about doing things to help families get.
That's a good idea, you know. And Missing Person Days event are good PR. Arkansas Attorney General, they always have great PR, and most political leaders really need good PR at times. So it is a good thing for them. It is something positive they can do to their community. We might not solve your case today, but we can give you some tools and resources that's going to improve your situation. So tell them, whether we solve these 50 cases you have in your state or not, are they better off now after this event? Yes. Do more people know that? Yes. So 50 success stories, whether we make an identification or not, we made movement. We made positive movement, and we made people understand what was going on. Even if it's one person at a time, that's what we have to do.
Well, thank you so much, Todd Matthews, for being part of this.
Absolutely.
And we will hope to talk to you again someday and hear more about NamUs success stories. And in the meantime, everybody,
Follow Todd on Facebook. He's always posting about missing persons cases. Go to the NAMIS site. We'll have links up on our site to help you do all that. And again, Todd, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I certainly appreciate you guys. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity.